Fighting a wildfire in Texas. Building a network to connect 40 million people to the internet. Cutting pollution with chainsaws. Hear Chubb customers tell their stories at chubb.com/podcast. And stay tuned after the show to hear how a family moved to Napa and created one of the largest private wineries in the world.
Hello, listeners. It is Thursday, December 7th, 2017. I'm Scott Bland, your host, and you are listening to Politico's Nerdcast. We are going to start off this week previewing the special Senate election in Alabama that is coming up on Tuesday, December 12th, right around the corner. And this week we saw President Trump and the Republican National Committee re-engage in the race despite the numerous allegations of sexual misconduct against Roy Moore, the Republican nominee. So we'll talk a little bit about what has gone on there in the past week, what is driving Trump's decision, and a little bit about what we expect to happen in Alabama. We're also going to talk about the latest in the sexual harassment allegations roiling Congress. There was a new one on Friday and also a new revelation about an old one involving a settlement of a claim with taxpayer money. So we will run through all of those and the resignation, of course, of Senator Al Franken, which happened as we were taping today. And for our final segment this week, we are going to have a special guest in to talk about Politico Playbook's 2018 power list. It's 18 people in politics who are going to matter in 2018. It covers operatives who run the big congressional groups, to people running some of the interest groups that are going to have a big say, to some of the candidates themselves who are running, to some behind-the-scenes players behind some big political names around the country. So we are going to talk through that as well, a very exciting segment. Quick note before we get started, remember you can email us questions at nerdcast@politico.com, and also don't forget to subscribe, rate us, and write written reviews of the Nerdcast on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. All right, let's start off this week by welcoming a couple of our regular guests, White House reporter Eliana Johnson. Hello.
Hello.
And White House reporter Nancy Cook. Hello, Nancy.
Hello.
All right, so we are going to start off this week talking about the White House's latest political gambit. Our first data point, $50,000. That is how much money the Republican National Committee transferred to the Alabama Republican Party the other day upon reengaging with the Alabama Senate race with just a few days to go. The RNC had pulled out along with most other pieces of the Republican Party apparatus after women came forward accusing Roy Moore of sexual misconduct, ranging from attempting to date them while they were teenagers and he was in his 30s to some who alleged sexual assault. So, but Trump, President Trump decided to reaffirm his endorsement for Moore earlier this week. He said that the country, certainly in his party, can't afford to have a liberal Democrat coming from Alabama to the Senate, and the RNC followed suit. So, Nancy, this all comes back to Trump, right? I mean, he said he personally thinks the accusations against Moore are BS, kind of coming back to what we talked about last week about this, like, on a number of issues, there's this reality distortion field that kind of is following him around. And now the RNC is following suit as he goes back in.
Right. I think it just goes to show that and just to be like one interesting point is I went back and read some of the Moore clips this morning, and Trump actually only endorsed Moore 2 days ago. To me, it feels like a week ago or like 4 weeks ago in Washington with like the pace of the news cycle and everything that's happening. But it was actually only 2 weeks ago or 2 days ago, excuse me. And the special election is this coming Tuesday. So like roughly a week before the special election, he did this. And I think it surprised a bunch of people in the White House. But I think it's just further evidence, you know, Republicans keep trying to distance themselves from Trump or, you know, try to take a moral ground. But at this point, like, Trump really is the owner of the Republican Party, at least in my view. You know, the RNC is backing him. You know, he completely ignored the advice of Majority Leader Mitch McConnell in doing this. You know, McConnell does not want Moore in the Senate. And Trump sort of went ahead and did this. And, you know, I think that he feels like he wants Moore in there. He's totally over willing to look these accusations that Moore is a child predator. He's put the Republicans in a really tricky spot on this in 2018. But, you know, he's going to go ahead and do it anyway.
Yeah. Eliana, what's your sense of kind of what happened leading up to this? And just, I don't know. I mean, does it say anything broader about Trump and the White House that we didn't already know? I've been kind of wrestling with that question a little bit.
Well, I'm in the process of writing a piece about this. And one thing that I've come across is essentially that White House aides had no indication that the president was going to endorse Luther Strange when he did so in the primaries, and they had no indication that he was going to come back around and endorse Moore when he did that. And I do think that speaks to the fact of this reality. It speaks to the reality in this White House that people really have no idea what this president is going to do on certain things at any given time. And a lot of what he does seems to be a like in physics, you know, every action has an equal and opposite reaction. Well, that's kind of how Trump behaves to the advice he's given. So when he's told that Roy Moore is a predator, you can't go there, his reaction to that is to inch closer to Roy Moore. And I think it raises this interesting question about how can you actually give this president advice? Is it possible to advise him in a constructive way, because it does seem like all the advice he was given about Roy Moore simply led him to dig his heels in and back the guy and to push the RNC back into this race. And I don't think either of those were things that really any other Republican, aside from maybe Roy Moore himself and his strongest backers in Alabama, wanted him to do.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that I don't think the RNC has like put out a statement about any of this. They do not seem particularly eager to own this re-engagement, but when party has the White House, the National Committee is essentially a political arm of the president, and here we are. That point about how to give Trump advice is interesting. I feel like that we've also seen some kind of notable examples in the past few weeks of, as we've seen all year, of how Trump advisors, either in the White House or around, also try and use the press to kind of float things forward to him. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But that is a tactic that is also in deep use.
Yeah, we saw that. We've seen that a bunch of times with immigration decisions, the DACA decision. You know, we saw that with the transgender ban. My understanding is that a bunch of lawyers were sort of saying to him, you know, well, let's study this some more. He didn't like being told that. You know, Mattis was against it, too. And Trump went ahead and just did the opposite and declared that there was going to be a transgender ban. I mean, we've seen this with policy decisions again and again. And Eliana's right. I think it makes it really hard for anyone in the White House to know how to present information to him. And it also, I think, just makes it really hard for the White House to make decisions or move forward or have policy discussions.
Yeah. So, you know, again, let's focus back in on Alabama. I mean, so this is coming up on December 12th. That's the next Tuesday. The other aspect of this, Eliana, is there's now a stronger sense than ever before that Moore is going to win, I think, is kind of the other aspect playing
into
this,
right? There are so many layers to this developing. Yeah, so Roy Moore is going to win. And Mitch McConnell's evolution on this, also, I think, forced by the president, is fascinating. This is a case in which I think the White House made a better political calculation than Mitch McConnell, which may be a first. But the White House saw the options to try to push Moore out of this race, all of them proposed by Mitch McConnell, and essentially said, we don't think any of these are good options, and so we're not going to push the president to come out publicly and say Moore should get out of this race. So the White House line from the beginning on this was that Alabama voters should decide. And that was a political calculation, not necessarily a matter of principle for them. They just didn't see a way, practical way, to push Moore out of the race. But McConnell was saying that he thought Moore should get out of the race and that he would move to, you know, there was speculation he would move to expel Roy Moore if he was elected, if he didn't get out and he was elected. McConnell is now taking the White House line and saying this is a matter for Alabama voters to decide, essentially conceding that Moore is likely to win. And I think he's unlikely to expel Moore if he is elected to the Senate. At the same time, this essentially explains, I think, a lot of why Democrats have moved aggressively to push Al Franken out of the Senate and draw a clear line for what behavior is acceptable for their members. And it puts them in a powerful position to squeeze McConnell and make the Republicans look terrible on this issue. And Paul Ryan could push Blake Farenthold out of the House. He hasn't done that yet. But it would be very hard for Mitch McConnell to expel Roy Moore from the Senate without cooperation from the majority of his conference, or to continue to dig his heels on this. He's in a really tough position.
I will say I think there's more of a chance than maybe you do that this never comes to pass and Moore ends up not becoming McConnell's problem because he loses. I think it's a small chance, but
you and Mitch McConnell will both be cheersing to that if that happens.
Well, so I just think that there's a couple things. I've been struck by a couple things looking at the race over the last weeks. One of them is the extent to which what's available publicly in terms of polling relies. The margins really tend to track with how big of a black vote that pollster expects. There are some that have ranged into the 17, the high teens percent for African Americans as a share of the electorate, and Moore is winning those handily. There are some that have ranged up more toward one quarter or even a little bit more of the electorate, and in those, Jones has been more competitive or even leading in a few polls. And the other thing about it that I just think is kind of interesting is that Jones, there aren't enough Democrats and Democratic leaning independents in Alabama for even if a bunch of Republicans who are disgusted with Roy Moore stay home, that's not enough for Jones to win. Right. It's just such a red state. So Jones is in this odd position of actually he needs to turn out Republicans to vote for him, not just to subtract their votes from Moore. And I think the moving pieces on those two big blocks of voters are just in terms of figuring out the turnout and how they're going to vote is just so hard to track that I wonder if there's just a little more uncertainty here going into Tuesday. I think you'd probably still bet on Moore given that he does seem to have rebounded in some of the public polling and it is Alabama. And certainly there's no evidence that he's totally cratered like Todd Akin did in Missouri in 2012. That's for sure. But I really don't know what to expect going into Tuesday. It'll be an interesting election night to watch.
I'm not convinced that Moore is going to win. Uh-huh. I think it's more likely than not.
More likely than not, you could even say, if you wanted to be punny about it.
But I'm
bummed. Well, and one thing to watch, of course.
He's here all week, everybody.
And I think one thing to watch is that, Trump is doing that rally in Pensacola on Friday night.
But that's crazy. He's going to Florida. He's not even going to Alabama because they planned this before he actually reendorsed the guy.
I know, but it'll be interesting to see sort of, I think, how he talks about Moore and what happened to Moore then. It might not even turn into a Moore rally. It could just be like
A Trump rally
yeah. where he relives the election and, talks about all the wonder how he's had more legislative victories than any other past president, which is not factually accurate. but, we don't know. But I think that'll be something interesting.
You never know what's going to happen at a Trump rally until the rally actually happens. Well, let's look. So the election's on Tuesday. We're going to be watching it. I believe the polls close at 8 Eastern time, 7 Central is when the final polls close in Alabama. But let's segue from here into. I know we talked about it last week, but there's so much happening every day in this story that I want to talk about sexual harassment in Congress again, and obviously Moore is a part of that. But the most recent accusation has been leveled against a freshman Democratic congressman named Reuben Kiewen.
This is my favorite guy now.
Oh yeah.
Because his defense is the best of all.
Yeah. Well, we'll get into that in a second. So our data point is 48.5%. This guy does not represent a safe Democratic district. This is a battleground seat. It's a Democratic-leaning battleground seat in Nevada outside Las Vegas. But it's one that's flipped back and forth between the parties in each of the last three elections since the district was drawn. He eked out a narrow victory in 2016. And then on Friday, a former campaign staffer told BuzzFeed that he repeatedly propositioned her and touched her inappropriately while she was on his staff, leading her to resign from the campaign. Eliana, the thing that struck me most about this was the reaction, which was immediate and actually contained within the story that broke this news, that the chairman of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, Ben Ray Lujan, called for Kiewen to resign in that story. Now, Kiewen did not take his advice, which was also
he's the Roy Moore of the Democratic Party
from Pelosi and Hoyer and all sorts of other people. But that's a big shift in just the last few weeks that we've seen from kind of this urging of deliberation on people who've come forward, whether it's Franken or John Conyers or others with allegations. And actually, it would seem to me that the arc of the Conyers story with Pelosi coming in for so much criticism for calling him an icon on Meet the Press to him ultimately resigning this week has played an important part in that that rapid evolution of how Kiwan was dealt with.
Yeah, and I also think that watching Republicans wrestle with this Roy Moore thing and Republicans getting hit with the Blake Farenthold news has made Democrats realize that there's a political opportunity, not just – well, there's a political opportunity and a moral opportunity. And so they've come to realize that pouncing on each and every one of these new allegations and pushing out their members puts them in a really strong position moving forward. And so we saw Democrats in succession, starting with Kirsten Gillibrand and a series of other Democratic female senators yesterday, call for Al Franken to resign. And he probably was accused of the tamest, relatively in terms of bad misconduct, accused of the tamest things. But I did like Kiwan's, I don't know how to pronounce
Kiwan,
his last name.
I think.
Kiwan's defense, which was that Democratic leadership knew about all these things before he was elected. Or was it before he was elected?
Well, so he's arguing.
They already knew about these things, essentially. So
the BuzzFeed story said basically, so this was, he was propositioning his finance director on his congressional campaign. She became very uncomfortable. She called, I guess, an acquaintance or a friend, colleague at the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee and told them that Kiwan was making her uncomfortable and she didn't want to work there anymore. And then at that point, that friend told someone else and it got back to the campaign manager that this was, but none of the specifics, at least according to that story, none of the specifics were ever raised. However, Kiwan has in looking for something to grab onto, has latched onto this and basically is lobbing bombs at his own party now, saying that Nancy Pelosi knew and Ben Ray Lujan knew about this and were fine with it before they spent millions of dollars on his campaign in 2016. Not the words of someone who seems to be planning to resign. Meanwhile, the woman who
Or a remorseful man.
Or a remorseful, that's true. meanwhile, the woman who finished second to him in his primary in 2016, Lucy Flores, has just been savaging him on Twitter. And also Harry Reid and the Culinary Union, which are the preeminent political powers in Nevada, which propped Kiwan up for a number of years. They were his big political patrons and supported him in that primary. And they have been coming in for some serious criticism from Flores and from others. Since all this came out just last week. This was on Friday. Meanwhile,
Al Franken might be resigning.
Meanwhile,
right now.
Yeah. So basically, like at just about this minute, the Nerdcast curse is
don't
in
make
full
us re-record
effect.
This segment, Al Franken.
So we assume Al Franken is scheduled
don't
to make
don't administer another blow to the body politic and make us re-record this segment.
So he's talking on the Senate floor this morning. It is presumed that he's going to resign after more than half of the Democratic Senate caucus called on him to do just that in the last day after our political colleague Heather Cagle broke another story about a woman who says
go,
that
Heather.
Franken forcibly kissed her in, I believe, 2006. This has taken the Franken situation took a long time to develop. And there was a lot of, oh, we're disappointed in him. We want an ethics committee investigation until the dam broke with this, the seventh accusation this week. And then you just saw this flood of starting with Democratic women senators and then kind of encompassing everyone else up to Minority Leader Chuck Schumer coming out and calling on him to resign on Wednesday. And so we'll see what happens today. But that happened very quickly.
I mean, this is like a no-cost lamb that Franken's the no-cost lamb that Democrats can sacrifice.
This is the argument you made the day the first accusation broke, right?
Yes, because there's a Democratic governor in Minnesota who can appoint a Democrat to fill his seat. And he allows Democrats to get the moral upper hand in all of this. So he's expendable.
Nancy?
No, I totally agree with that. And also, I feel like I feel like the Democratic senators were like a bit slow. It felt like a little bit
of Senate slow.
I felt like it was a little bit of a slow burn with the Franken stuff, actually. But I mean, compared to Nancy Pelosi coming out and kind of not really roasting Conyers right away. Do you know what I mean? In those initial appearances on Sunday shows where she seemed more tolerant of it, I feel like this definitely, Eliana's right, gives the Senate Democrats more moral ground and also shows, you know, when you compare this to Farenthold that, like, you know, they're willing to take action. But it's so interesting because, you know, I've talked to other people this week as I've been writing other stories and, you know, some Republicans are thrilled that like, you know, Republicans who want to ram this tax plan through as quickly as possible, just as a quick side note, are thrilled that all of this sexual harassment stuff is taking up so much oxygen.
Just because there's less focus now on the tax bill? That's incredible.
They're like, oh, I talked to one Republican last night who was like, oh, you know, I don't want to be cynical, but it's amazing that this, you know, Al Franken's going to resign as we're going to conference committee.
I don't want to be cynical, but how great is it that there's...
How great that they're going to get to write it in the dark.
Oh, my God. So just a few quick notes on Minnesota that I think are interesting. Another aspect of this is that at least at this point, it appears that Governor Mark Dayton, the Democratic governor in Minnesota, is leaning toward naming his lieutenant governor, Tina Smith, to the post as a placeholder until a 2018 special election to fill the final 2 years of Franken's term, which is up in 2020. And so that's just another bit of, you know, a political angle to this, to appointing a woman to hold the seat until
I think he'll definitely
election.
Appoint a woman.
And there's also a few other women in statewide elected office among Minnesota Democrats. The one thing about this, though, is that I think very, very quietly, because the state hasn't, you know, it didn't flip to Trump and whatever, but Minnesota has been moving.
1 point.
Yeah, right.
It's the most Democratic of all those upper mid. Every single one of those other upper Midwest states went to Trump. Unexpectedly in this election, Wisconsin, Iowa,
Michigan,
North Dakota, South Dakota, which are always Republican. But every single one of those, Minnesota was the only holdout. So
and Clinton only won it by like one and a half points.
One and a half points.
There's an argument to be made and that I...
But that means I don't think it's moving into the Republican column anytime
just because
soon.
Of the momentum
yes,
of 2018.
Yes.
I think despite that, there's an argument to be made that Minnesota is going to be the most interesting state in the country politically in 2018. You've got two... Republican-held House seats in the Minneapolis-St. Paul suburbs that are very close. Clinton won one of them. You've got three Democratic-held seats that Trump
won. My cousin is running
won.
For Congress.
That's right.
Really?
In the third.
Yeah, Minnesota 3.
Yeah,
wow. Pete Phillips. Give him a shout-out.
One of several liquor moguls in
yes.
in the House.
What part of the state is he running in?
It's suburban Minneapolis.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Cool.
So that's Eric Paulson's seat. That's the one that Clinton won and is held by a Republican. There are three Democratic seats that Trump won by double digits. There's going to be Amy Klobuchar's up for re-election. That's not expected to be particularly interesting, but there could be now a special election to replace Franken, an open governor's race. That's a very crowded primaries on both sides. There's going to be a lot going on in Minnesota next year. Very exciting.
I'm thrilled.
One final thing before we break here, though, is Eliana, you just brought this up. There's the case of Republican Congressman Blake Farenthold as well. And we've talked about him in past episodes. We have known in the past he was accused. There was a court case.
Yes.
He was accused by a former staffer of sexual harassment. What we didn't know until Friday was that the House of Representatives paid $84,000 of taxpayer money in a settlement to make this case go away. Farenthold, he's got the filing deadline in Texas is on Monday. This is all happening very close. And then the primaries are in March. There's been some talk about a primary challenger, but notably, Farenthold has not faced the same calls
right.
to
I mean,
get
why
out
Paul
as everyone
Ryan,
else.
He's, why Paul Ryan has just not shoved him out the door and made a big deal of doing so, I do not understand. I've been wondering if there's something we don't know about this. Like, Farenthold has, like, naked pictures of Paul Ryan in his desk or something. I mean, seriously, I don't understand it.
And it just gets back to the point that you made about Franken. And, like, Franken is a very high-profile Democratic senator. He raises a lot of money for the party. And yet, he's expendable. He will be replaced. And
right.
the party is not – ultimately, in a year, no one is going to, like, miss having his voice there. Blake Farenthold is the backbencher to end all backbenchers. He doesn't do anything. He's widely viewed as an embarrassment, and yet he's not being shoved toward the exit in the same way. I think it's odd.
It's striking.
Yeah. Anyway, we'll see what happens. All right, for our third and final segment this week, we are going to talk about the Playbook Power List. That was a list of and profiles of 18 key political players to watch in 2018. And we have, for the first time in studio, our researcher and Politico Playbook producer, Zach Montalaro, in the studio because he quarterbacked this project. He interviewed all these folks, wrote these profiles, just came out the other day. Zach. Welcome.
Great to be here, Scott. Thanks for having me.
It is good to have you.
Yeah.
It is good. I think it's good for the listeners to be able to put a voice to this faceless research titan that they've heard so much about for years now.
I was always told I had a face for radio, so this is the best way to do it, too.
All right. Yeah. So let's talk about this list. 18 for 18.
18 for 18.
Very, very snappy. So it includes some people running some of the big political groups that are driving next year's big elections, some of the people you may not have heard of behind some powerful politicians. Let's roll through the list a little bit. This podcast is at its core about elections. So tell us a bit about the big players in the battle for the House of Representatives that you profiled. It's the head of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee and the head of Congressional Leadership Fund.
Right. So when we were making this list, we kind of split it across and we said, what's the big thing to come out of 2018? And of course, it's going to be the election. And of course, it's going to be the House. So we're looking at Dan Cena, who is the head of the DCCC, and Corey Bliss, who's the head of the Senate Leadership Fund.
Congressional Leadership Fund.
I'm sorry, Congressional Leadership Fund and the American Action Network as well. He's the president of that.
And those are like the big – the main Republican House outside groups.
Right. And the battle for the House will really be a battle between the two of them because the Democrats really lack a large, organized, you know, well-funded outside group. So it really relies on the party committee to handle it. And Dan Cena is still feeling very bullish. Him and the Democrats, you know, have laid out a roadmap that they think they can take back the House. And for them right now, they're feeling like they have a really good shot at it. I profiled Dan. I was talking to Dan, and they said as of this week, they have 91 Republican-held seats that they think that they have a shot in. And that's a huge number. They only need to win 24.
91, that's
It's stretching it.
I think Corey Bliss would quibble with that.
I think Corey Bliss would probably quibble with that too. But it just shows to show you how confident they're feeling if they can even say, you know, we're looking at 91 seats. They're not looking at, you know, 50. They're not looking at just the bare minimum they need to take the House. They said, we think that, you know, we're just about a year out from the election, that we think that there's 91 places that we can put, you know, we can put in money and we at least have a shot at winning. And then Corey Bliss, on the other hand, which was profiled by Anna Abbott Palmer, the lead writer for Playbook, or one of the lead writers, his job is really going to be try to like stem that tide and make sure they don't pick up those 24 seats. And his big benefit is that he is superbly well funded. He's an outside group. He's got backing from just about every major Republican donor, and he will have the money to throw. Not quite everywhere he wants. That'll be a challenge for him as we get closer and closer to Election Day, but to defend a lot of his seats with a lot of money. Just today, just this morning, in Playbook this morning, they announced a $2 million ad buy in 24 districts on the tax bill. And this is, you know, 11 months away from the election, so they are really ready to fight for every inch.
Wow. And that, to be clear, that's not a political ad. This is an issue ad. Right. This is just trying to boost like
– this is an issue ad. But
yeah. This is just trying to boost the party on tax reform, which we've seen a couple new polls out this week. The tax bill is not well liked.
No, it's not. And speaking of polls too, you know, I think the headwinds are heading towards Democrats. And say what you want about generic ballot polls. You know, Charlie's not a huge fan, I know. But RCP this morning had Democrats up 8 in a generic ballot. That's a good sign for Dan Cena. That's something that he is feeling pretty confident about, almost a year away from the election.
I think it's so interesting just getting to meet some of these people behind all this money, which, first of all, like dealing with that much money that these folks do seems like a response. Like, I would struggle to get out of bed sometimes in the morning knowing that it's like, oh, I'm going to spend a few million dollars today. Yeah. Like, that seems like a lot of responsibility, but also I just think that like the contrast in personalities there is interesting. Like Dan Cena is like very much has been a kind of behind the scenes kind of head down operative for a while. Corey Bliss is a little bit more front facing. He has a kind of theory of the case about how politics, how campaigns are won, that focuses very much on field organizing and some stuff like that, which is a little rarer on the Republican side. But he's an evangelist for his type of campaigns, and he goes out there and he sells them. And it's just, you know, kind of interesting contrast in personalities in addition to the obviously contrasting goals between the Democratic Congressional Committee and the House Republican Super PAC.
Right. And when I talked to Dan too, he kind of recognized that in the past that Democrats may have been lacking in working with their grassroots, and he said that's a concerted goal of them is to, you know, empower their grassroots, which of course everyone is going to say. But Dan Cena was a big fan of saying we need to arm the rebels. So I think, you know, we'll see that battle on the ground this year.
I like that. Arm the Rebels, especially with the new Star Wars movie coming out.
Star Wars. Very exciting. We're a week away.
Yeah. All right. Let's pivot. Tell us about some of the candidates on the power list and why they were on there.
So we had a handful of candidates. I think probably the most interesting ones is Josh Hawley in Missouri and Kevin DeLeon in California.
Tell us a little more about them. Yeah.
Yeah. So Josh Hawley is a very interesting case. He's the current attorney general in Missouri and the likely nominee for Republican Senate race in 2018. you know, it's not his yet, but what makes him really interesting is that he has both, you know, he has the backing of just about every aspect of the Republican Party. He is the chosen candidate of Mitch McConnell, but he's also the chosen candidate of Steve Bannon and the president. When the president was there last week for a – or two, you know, recently, when he was there recently for a tax rally, he called out Josh in the audience and said, there's our next senator. There's our next senator. So not an explicit endorsement, but read into that what you will. And but Steve Bannon has also said, this is our guy. This is our guy, which is something that we've basically not seen, right? Something
that's really interesting. Consensus. Yeah.
Consensus. Consensus in the Republican Party, which is a rare thing today, is had in Josh Hawley. And Claire McCaskill, his, you know, would-be challenger, or he is the would-be challenger to Claire McCaskill. She's probably the most endangered Democratic Senate candidate too. So it, you know, if there's one battle to watch, it's going to be theirs.
Yeah, and we talk a lot all the time about those 10 Senate Democrats in Trump states, and McCaskill in one of the five that Trump won by double digits. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, that's definitely been a formula for success for Senate Republicans in the past. Like a number of their candidates who won in 2014 when they took back the Senate. I'm thinking about Tom Cotton in Arkansas, Dan Sullivan in Alaska were folks who like brought together both kind of the more leadership aligned outside groups like, say, mm-hmm. the Chamber of Commerce, but then also the Club for Growth. And now, obviously, Trump and kind of his base have added like a third dimension to that right. fight within the Republican Party. But it's still interesting to see. We should know. I think the Club for Growth is very high on Hawley, too. I don't know if they've officially endorsed him yet, but I think they have. Meanwhile, on the flip side, we got Kevin DeLeon, the state Senate president in California, mm-hmm. who's primarying. Well, kind of. California's a little weird. We'll get into yes. that. But he's running against Dianne Feinstein, the mm-hmm. longtime sitting Democratic senator.
Yeah, he's an interesting case too, because he's someone who's relatively young and was seen as the future of the party in that state. And he had options in 2018 to run for what would have assuredly been his, you know, election that would more or less hand it to him, either, you know, lieutenant general or lieutenant governor.
Lieutenant general.
Lieutenant general. Newly elected position. Lieutenant governor or you know, other statewide offices. And he said, no, I'm tired of the Democratic establishment. That's really what he's going for. And what a lot of young Democratic activists in California are looking at is can we take out a senator that's been in Washington for years and years and years and years? And it's certainly an uphill battle. He recognizes it. He calls it a David versus Goliath fight. But the fact that he even is willing to try to challenge her is interesting. And, you know, like you said, too, the jungle primary just adds an extra element of surprise to this. It could be two Democrats. It could be no Democrats. That's probably not going to happen. But
usually when you end up with no Democrats, it's because there isn't an incumbent. If there's an incumbent in there, typically that hasn't – although we've certainly seen some high-profile examples right. of that in the House of Representatives. The thing about DeLeon that makes me wonder is that this is a guy – obviously he's – risen up the political ladder, and so he's got some prominence mm-hmm. In a way that is usually helpful for these kind of campaigns. But also, like and he's very progressive. He's a supporter of single payer health care, and that's a boon too. But when full time state legislatures like California's, you end up in a lot of like horse trading with and involvement with lobbyists and big business interests and stuff like that. And I just wonder if if someone and maybe at the end of the day, Feinstein is unbeatable. And that's certainly a possibility. But if she is beatable, I just wonder if some of that stuff – he's not like the 100% pure progressive with like kind of nothing to attack that, right. that might be able to ride the moment. Maybe no one is. But it's just I'm kind of curious to see how some of that stuff plays out, because if you rise to the level of becoming a chamber leader in a state legislature, you are doing a lot of horse trading and deal making and carrot and stick stuff. And sometimes that doesn't end up looking too good on the campaign trail.
Yeah. One thing we have to watch for him, too, is the creeping allegations, not against him, but within the California chamber of sexual harassment. It's been grappling with a lot of high-profile cases that he, to be clear, he is not accused of anything, but
– But how leaders dealt with
right,
it
exactly.
is definitely at
exactly.
issue.
So that'll certainly come up, certainly running against a woman senator as well.
Yeah, that's really interesting. All right. So let's – now – so we've done some of the big – party groups. We've done some of the candidates. What about some of the interest groups that are kind of mm-hmm. Out there floating around for 2018, their plans and, who's at the helm?
Yeah. One good person to look at if we're looking at, the Bannon side of the Republican Party is Andy Sarabian. He's really Bannon's right-hand man, and he was – Daniel Lipman talked to him for this, and he is, of course, bullish on his party's chances. He thinks that the Bannon way is the way forward. and they have some of the money to back that up. The good way to look at Andy Sarabian is that he is a senior leader of the Great America Alliance, which is a super PAC, and they're the ones that really are still backing Roy Moore through thick and through thin. Just this past week, after the president formally endorsed Roy Moore, they dropped something north of $100,000 on the race, and they've already said we're willing to, you know, plug a lot more money into that race if we have to. So he views himself as on the front line of protecting the president's agenda and folding the Steve Bannon agenda, which will
not be, always the same thing.
Which is not always the same thing, but it will also clash with Mitch McConnell, and his chosen candidates will not always be the chosen candidates of the Republican establishment in D.C.
Yeah, I think that there are a few Senate primaries brewing across the landscape that could be interesting. Missouri, not one of them, as we just mentioned, but you know, potentially West Virginia could be one. There's a few others out there.
How far they'll wade into something like Arizona with Kelly Ward would be interesting to see too.
Yes, that
Kelly
is
Ward
for sure.
It's very much a Bannonite.
Definitely. That's a big one. Kelly Ward. And so Jeff Flake has announced his retirement there, but Congresswoman Martha McSally is expected to jump in, but she is viewed with suspicion by some kind of pro-Trump forces. It's interesting to see. Ever since it became clear that she was almost certainly going to be running for Senate, she's been appearing on Fox News and on Twitter a lot more praising Trump than before. And it seems like this is like a new bit of the campaign checklist for Republican candidates. Now, you got to line up your campaign staff, campaign manager, all that stuff. You got to line up your donors. Got to tweet nice things about Trump.
And you got to at least make sure that, you know, if the Bannon wing is not angry at you, maybe not their best friend, but you probably don't want these guys angry.
It seems in Arizona just the act of running against Kelly Ward is enough to provoke the anger at this point. So we will see what happens there. That's a late primary. That's going to be happening in August of next year. So that's a lot of time to percolate. What about on the flip side? You know, we've been talking a bit about in the last segment, and you just brought up with regard to the California state legislature, sexual harassment in politics is a huge issue, maybe like one of the big stories of 2018. One of the interesting things we saw with Franken was how the the first Democratic senators who came out calling for his resignation were the women in the caucus. And one of the people on the power list was Stephanie Shriok, who's the president of Emily's List, whose job is to promote pro-abortion rights, Democratic women in office up and down the ballot, but especially House and Senate.
Right. Yeah. Stephanie Shriok's an interesting case too, because now more than ever, we're seeing Democratic women say this is the year of the woman, and if someone's going to lead that charge, it's her. Her group, Emily's List. You know, of course, they're always influential, but they've seen this year just a groundswell of support and a groundswell of interest from women across the country, Democratic women specifically across the country, who want to run for office. They told us that, you know, 22,000 women have reached out to them saying, "Hey, I'm considering a run," and that's huge. You can't overstate that, how big that group is, and that's a group that they're trying to harness.
Wow.
Yeah, that's huge, and it's much more compared to last cycle where they said less than 1,000 people said they're interested. So we're still a year out. There's still time for people to get in, and they've already done 22 times what they did the entirety of 2016, where a woman was leading the Democratic Party.
Yeah. I think it's interesting. If you go through and kind of look down the roster of the big House races around the country, there are a ton of female candidates. Some of them aren't going to win their primaries, but a lot are. I think arguably the top three or three of the top four candidates in Virginia 10, right across the river from the studio, are women. Arguably the best pickup opportunity for Democrats in Darrell Issa's district in Southern California. You've got a woman just jumped in the last quarter. You've got two or three women running in the 45th district nearby. You've got a few running in the 39th, you know, in the 25th district, 39th district. You just run through the map. There are a ton of women candidates, so much so that Emily's List hasn't endorsed some in some of these primaries yet because there are enough running against each other that they're just going to wait and see who wins and then probably endorse some of them for the general election, right?
Yeah. And I would probably say this is a good problem they like to have, that they'd rather have, you know, an embarrassment of riches than have less candidates run. So they're someone to watch.
Yeah. All right. Well, this is a lot of good stuff here for us to look forward to. What's the one thing that you took away from the power list that you think we should, and the whole project of putting this stuff together, that you think we should be paying attention to in 2018, a really good story that's coming down the pike?
So I think one thing I took away is that we hear now about how the Republican Party is the fractured party, how there's two very different competing wings of that party. That's true for the Democratic Party as well. There's no party that's not facing inner turmoil. You know, we see a primary challenger to one of the oldest, one of the longest serving senators in California. We see a group like Bernie acolytes in Our Revolution, you know, pushing the Democratic Party to the left. So both sides are really grappling with their identity. And the 18 people on our list really highlight that these are the 18 people that will decide not only their party's future but the country's futures too. It's whoever wins their respective battles will reshape the map in 2018 and 2019 and 2020.
Yeah, I agree completely with that. And it's part of the reason I'm so excited for the fact that 2018 is almost here. And
like, almost here.
The best way for the parties to figure out who they are is who they vote for in primaries. And those primaries are fast approaching. We got the first ones coming up in March. Zach, thank you so much for coming in and talking us through all this. This was great.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
All right. And of course, as always, a big thank you to you, our listeners. Remember, you can email us if you have questions at nerdcast@politico.com. And remember to subscribe, rate us, and write written reviews of the Nerdcast on Apple Podcasts or your preferred podcast platform. Also, thank you to our producer, Matt Sobosinski, our associate producer, Michaela Rodriguez, our illustrator, Bill Cookman, and our researcher and Politico Playbook producer and now Nerdcast guest, Zach Montalaro. And, of course, thank you to you, our listeners. We will talk to you again next week.
This podcast was made possible by Chubb. Hear how this family created one of the largest private wineries in the world right now.
We started making wine in 1948, one bottle at a time. Today, we produce nearly 20 million cases a year. Chubb has helped us grow for the past 30 years. They helped us prevent equipment problems during harvest and provided guidance when we started exporting internationally. Now we're working with them on cybersecurity. My grandfather taught me to make a wine that over-delivers. Chubb over-delivers.
Hear more stories at chubb.com/podcast.